session number 10743, rule 3.
Mr. Treadwell, rule 3.
As I say, back at base, we only then discovered what the noise was. We'd been carrying a larger than usual high-capacity bomb, and it had not been possible to close the bomb doors, and a cable had been used, for some reason or other, around the bomb itself. This may have been standard practice for the bigger ones. And the cable had been trapped in between the bomb doors as they closed and was wanging either side of the aircraft as we turned. And this approximated to what we thought was light flak firing at us. So, to my mind, although we saw lots of aircraft shot down, and obviously it was a very serious raid, I remember this as one of the raids when we were more apprehensive about what might have happened than actually did happen. This is one that stands out in our memory. We really thought we were on fire at low level over a heavily defended target and therefore wouldn't stand a chance of getting out. Yet in this case, it really was nothing serious at all.
It must have been one of the longest raids you did.
Peenemünde, 7 hours 40 minutes, yes, on the 17th of August, 43.
Was it explained to you beforehand the importance of this raid, why it was so important?
We were told, yes, it was, I think that was on the occasion, we had Harris himself visit our station, though I'm not sure of that, he did visit once. We were told the target was so important that despite the fact that the moon was up and would be for some while, that we would go back to the target night after night until we obliterated it. But we were told that it was because they were developing a new anti-bomber device, and it was absolutely in our own interest that we should smash the place up. A sort of carrot, which, you know, I don't think it mattered very much at that particular time, but certainly it gave a reason for the importance of this particular station being bombed, so there it was.
They obviously couldn't risk giving you the real reason.
No, because the Germans apparently didn't even realise that we knew where Peenemünde was at that stage prior to the raid itself.
What kind of an impression did Harris make on you?
It was only a very brief one, but it's difficult to say, but he seemed such a nice, mild-mannered sort of individual. There was a lot of confidence, I think, we got from the few minutes he appeared. But as I say, my memory's a bit hazy at this distance now, 40-odd years ago. But I think that he was really liked by his people. There was he was called Butch, but that was almost, Butcher, that was almost an affectionate term as far as the aircrew were concerned. I don't think there was any animosity towards him whatsoever that I ever heard of.
Now, you were going to recount the Hamburg raid as well.
Yes, Hamburg at the towards the end of July 1943, it was decided for the first time to use window. This was the strips that were dropped to foil the both the anti-aircraft guns and also of a different wavelength, those of the devices of the night fighters. On the 27th of July, the first of four raids took place on Hamburg, the idea of being that there would be separate areas of the target to be destroyed. Hamburg was certainly a target that was not liked either. So that when you flew down, as we did, from the north across the canal there, we fully expected, despite all that we've been told, to be really battered by flak. However, it proved to be exactly as they said. As we were dropping the window, the wireless operator was dropping it through a chute, and it was spreading out below us like confetti all over the place. It really worked beautifully. We were able to go right across, bomb our target without any particular trouble whatsoever, and come back almost on an uneventful trip. Now, that was followed by, we went off on leave after that, and I believe there were another two, but we came back in time on the 2nd of August, a few days later. We went on a day's leave, that's right. We came back, and this was to be the Harcourt area of Hamburg, the southeastern quarter, we were briefed. The weather was very, very bad, or projected weather was bad, and it was known there was a front with a terrific amount of icing in it that was going towards Germany. The weather experts were trying to guess exactly when it would get to Hamburg, and the decision was that the raid would take place. However, just as our squadrons were taking, and the Halifax squadrons were taking off, the news came through that front was right over Hamburg, and that all Halifaxes who hadn't got the ceiling of the Lancasters were to be grounded. However, unfortunately, from two or three squadrons in Yorkshire, some of the Halifaxes had already taken off, and because of the wireless silence, weren't informed of this situation. Our crew was one of them. We flew across, and when we came to the German coast, we were absolutely staggered to find this front right the way up. Our top ceiling normally was between 18 and 20, 20 if we were lucky with a full bomb load on, and we could see this was about 20,000 in places. However, we flew on and then found ourselves for the next half an hour or so in one of the worst situations we've ever been in, were ever in at that time, just from the weather. We were icing up terribly. Icing on the wings of a plane works in two ways. It can accumulate in tons over a few minutes, increasing the weight of the aircraft, but also it changes the camber on the wings. Most from a modern aircraft, most lift comes from the top of the aircraft, from the shape and the vortex caused by the air going over it. If the ice settles there, then it changes the shape and you lose lift as well. We found ourselves like a cork. We were going up. Every time the pilot would try to give more power, we'd go up a little, then we'd drop 1,000, 2,000 feet at a time. And we'd been going for about 10 minutes, and suddenly a brilliant light lit up the aircraft. It was what the old-time sailors called St. Elmo's fire. The gunner, first of all, reported that he'd got runaway guns. They met up a gunner because there were jets of flame, probably 15, 20 feet, going from all of his four guns, and he thought that somehow an electrical failure was firing them. But then we realised that the four air screw discs were lit up with light as well, and I was in the front, in the nose, and I was able to read my map, look at my map and make out things which, and there was no other lighting at that particular time, and it really was horrendous. So we didn't realise what all this lighting was, and we weren't sure what effect it was having on the aircraft, but the instruments seemed to react. Anyway, we decided that we'd drop our bombs on the ETA and try and turn back and come back. Well, we did. We came back. We saw nothing all this time, and we were still going up and down, and the ice was coming off the propellers and hitting the side of the cockpit as it got thrown over. It really was a tremendous time. The only thing we saw on the ground was, as we came what we judged to be over the German coast, looking back, we could see a few searchlights and some flak going up, and a few lights on the ground, which we assumed was Hamburg. Whether we bombed Hamburg, we really didn't know at all. But we managed to get back without much trouble to base. The funny thing is, in the officially commissioned history of World War II, of the RAF and World War II, states that no Halifaxes or Stirlings took off that night. However, my own logbook and the logbook of a pathfinder, Mr. S. Honey, records the fact some Halifaxes did take off. An article in the Evening News of September the 28th, 1954, takes up this point and mentions that Mr. Honey was writing to the ministry to have this officially changed.
Now, the raids which you've recounted all took place with 77 Squadron on your first tour of duty, I believe.
Yes, that's true.
How long did that go on for?
We finished our last trip on the 12th of November, 1943, and the first one, of course, was towards the end of April that same year. So that would be, about 6 months, something like that.
What condition would you be in after that first tour? How much did it take out of you?
I think there was definitely nervous tension towards the end, but I wasn't conscious at that time of anything particularly. We were taken off operations at the end to do special duties, and we were looking forward to special duties, which we didn't know if it would, we might have involved more operational flying. We weren't unduly dismayed, but as it happened, the special duties were merely going over to a Lancaster group to teach people to fly on Halifaxes, because there was a shortage of Lancasters at that time. There were rumours of strikes at some of the Lancaster factories. And so for a period in 1943-44, pilots coming off Wellingtons had to go fly Halifaxes for a while, do their conversion to four-engine flying on Halifaxes, and then only in the last day or two of their course to switch to Lancasters. This took place over about 5 or 6 months that I was on the squadron, and for that reason I moved from four group, which was a Halifax-only group, down to one group, which had been Lancaster only. We went on to the heavy conversion units within the that particular area.
When did your next tour start then?
We weren't officially required to go back, but we'd volunteered because my pilot, who's then Flight Sergeant Daffy, had become bored up in northern Scotland with his duties, and I'd asked to be returned to Ops and was told that it couldn't happen. It was too short a time. However, he deliberately put up as we called it, a black, and got himself posted back. The black consisted of... the station was rather a formal one, and the group captain kept to the rules and regulations, peacetime one. My skipper, who literally drank very, very little indeed, was drunk on board a donkey going through the main doors into the officers' mess and round the lounge. As a result, he was posted immediately back to an operational squadron. He phoned us. We were dispersed at that time. We had been, of course, seven. And we were able to contact five of us. Our rear gun had gone back to Canada, and we only had to replace the wireless operator, who himself had already gone back on early. We all gathered together, and we had to report to a place called Ruffoth, just outside York, for our conversion to a new mark of Halifax, which was the Mark III.
Was it much different?
Oh, the power was terrific. It was the same standard of comfort, but it really was an excellent aircraft. The only problem we found initially was a fault in the engines, which we never fully understand, but while the engines were going at full tilt, it was possible for the centre of the engine to freeze solid, while the heat was being exuded all the way around the centre, and this caused the aircraft, the engine eventually to stop. And we had two or three examples of this on tentative flights, which we had to come back to base with. They apparently cured this, and so we had no trouble, and we certainly had no trouble on operations after that. We did 20 trips in fairly quick succession.
Which squadron was this with?
Number 10 squadron. There was one thing that irritated us a little bit. At the time, we were doing a lot of... the RAF Bomber Commander were doing a lot of short trips to the flying bomb bases and other places in France, which meant that your time over enemy territory was something like 10, 15 or 20 minutes. Now, compared with the Ruhr or Berlin, which often meant several hours over enemy territory and exposed to fighter attacks, or Berlin, probably 4 or 5 hours, this was rather small. It was felt a little unfair when we were told that as experienced crews, we would not be allowed to undertake any of these trips or count them as operations. A system had been devised about that time whereby crews doing these short trips only counted as a half towards their total, or either as a first or second tour. I believe in some cases even one third later. But we were never allowed to do these at all, and we had to be content with Ruhr and other targets right the way through. As I say, it was a little irritating at times, particularly when the people were back in a very, very short time, having added yet another one to their logbook.
Are there any particular raids that stick out in your mind from this second tour?
We did one raid on Bokum, which was much the same as most other raids, flak fighters and things like this, but of no great moment until we realised that we'd been hit somewhere in the hydraulic system, and our hydraulics were US, and therefore there were no flaps or brakes for us to land, and accordingly we were diverted to Woodbridge in Suffolk, which was one of the three so-called lame duck drones. We landed there uneventfully and parked the aircraft on the side, slept, and when we woke up next morning, found that the tail of our own aircraft had been sliced off in the night, or one fin of it had been sliced off by another aircraft slewing as it came to a stop. I was most amused to overhear other people looking at the same aircraft and saying, "Christ, how the hell did they get that plane down?" Because the tail had gone on ours. But they were looking at our aircraft, not realising that it happened after we'd landed. But anyway, that was amusing. During the next couple of hours, we saw there'd been a rather large raid of American bombers, daylight bombers, the Sterling Fortresses and Liberators. And we watched a lot of these, which have been badly shot up, coming into land. And it says a terrific amount for the skill of these pilots, the way some of these aircraft were able to land reasonably intact. But one in particular, we noticed a fortress had two engines out on one side, and it was flying on two engines on the same side. It was making a crabwise approach to come in, and as it came down towards the ground, one of the other two engines started to belch smoke. The pilot, despite this, managed to put it down and did what was virtually a complete circle, just touching and turning, but still managing to keep it right way up. And that was funny, and it would have been tragic otherwise, but suddenly every port in the aircraft opened and men appeared from everywhere, pouring out, and within seconds the whole plane was abandoned. There was almost a comic scene over the way that everything happened at once. Of course, there were 11 crew in these fortresses, and speed was the essence when getting out of a damaged plane.
That was on the same night?
That was the next morning, because we'd slept there overnight in the special accommodation for air crew who'd been referred there one way or the other. The other... most of the other trips had their own series of little events that took place, but one that I particularly remember was we were going to Cologne on the 30th of December 1944. Because of there had been one or two unfortunate accidents where aircraft had had one engine fail on takeoff, and therefore had spun into the ground, my skipper had evolved a theory that he would hold the nose of the aircraft down right to the last minute, so that should an engine fail, at least he'd have a chance to lift the aircraft over the trees at the bottom of the end of the runway and give us a possible chance to get away with crashing with a full bomb and petrol load. So, following that technique, on this particular night, he took the aircraft right down the runway, even though it was trying to get off. He kept holding a nose down. We'd just got to the end of the runway when there was... and he'd started to come off the ground. Then there was a terrific flash, and we had the experience of going up in a high-speed lift. We didn't know what was happening then. It was dusk, and... we looked round and thought at first we'd hit something on the ground, then possibly an aircraft, but we couldn't, looking down, see any wreckage anywhere. But the rear gunner reported a terrific pall of smoke from behind us. Anyway, the aircraft seemed to be flying all right, so the skipper asked myself to go round and check the aircraft. I went back and checked everything that was visible, then I thought I'd have a look at the bomb ports, and I opened them up, and what should have been... the inside of the bomb bays, visible to me, was instead the ground. Our main bomb that night, occupying the whole of the centre section, was a blast bomb. It had fallen off, we didn't know at the time how, and had taken the bomb doors and part of the fuselage to which it was attached as well. So we were virtually naked underneath. We discovered later that although of course it fell with all the fuses intact, it had blown up. It was a feature of these bombs that with the light case that the fuses themselves will be driven in to the bomb itself and blow up anyway, even with the safety pins in place. But they would usually, the explosion was roughly about two-thirds of its fullest capacity. So probably we're lucky there. It must have hit the ground and carried us up, we reckon something like 600 feet. The aircraft seemed to be flying quite well. The skipper tried it out, and then we again had our little sort of crew conference and decided that as our route this time was down to, I believe, the Isle of Wight, certainly to the Channel, then go across France, then cut up into Cologne that way, we decided we'd go down to the Channel, drop our bombs. We'd have used up quite a bit of petrol. We'd drop our bombs and come back. We got down to the Channel, and the skipper said, well, if anything, the plane's flying better than usual. So we decided that we'd carry on with the main stream. We did, and we dropped our stuff on Cologne in due course with the usual resistance and so on there. But it wasn't until we actually came back and were landing that we had any trouble at all. And then as we came down, possibly due to a build-up of air inside the aircraft, we began to skid all over the air, or it seemed to be, but we were fortunately able to touch down reasonably well and on our own wheels, and we sort of were perfectly okay there. There was a slight sequence to this too, which I found rather amusing, and we all found rather amusing at the time. That was that, a sequel I should say, we'd been doing some bombing practice on our bombing range, which was situated just off the end of the runway of 10 Squadron's drone, and I'd had an argument with the people on the so-called quadrants who plotted the bombs when they fell. What I hadn't realised at the time was we had quite a serious fault in our bomb sight, and the scatter of bombs they'd given me on a plot chart I disagreed with. Anyway, it was found that there was an error in the bomb sight, and when corrected it brought back to a reasonable figure. But I was certainly at loggerheads with the people. Now, when apparently the senior officer of in charge of the quadrants on the range came in next morning, there was a large crater on his range, a colossal great crater for results of this bomb. And he inquired, and someone said, well, an aircraft had dropped a bomb. And he phoned up the station and said, what happened? They told him this blast bomb had dropped. And he said, who was the pilot? And they said, Treadwell. And apparently there was a silence for a moment. He said, Christ, I didn't think he'd take it that badly. Because I'd had this argument with him. But anyway, that may or may not be of any interest to you.
Did you ever read submarine pens?
No. No, that was another one of these short-term ones. They could be quite hectic because you've got a hell of a lot of flak. And we had a healthy respect for flak at night. So what they must have been like in daylight. What we hated was light flak, because we'd seen aircraft shot down by light flak. And it was cruel to see an aircraft going down already in flames, absolutely being hosepiped by shells. Technique on near place on the coast was to get, if an aircraft was hit up above, the searchlights would bring it down. They would come right down with it as far as they could, and the light flak would open up. And as I say, hosepipe was the right thing, because shells would come up seemingly by the thousand to cut them to pieces before they even touched the ground.
Even though it was a stricken plane.
Oh yes, because they couldn't take a chance on, well, that was the reasoning behind this. He wouldn't take a chance on it getting away.
So flak worried you more than night fighters?
No, that's not quite true. It was more of a, how should I say, psychological worry than the fighters, although flak was funny. Going over a target, in the light of all the light that peered over a target normally, you'd see what appeared to be almost like a chainmail barrier. Thousands of puffs of smoke where shells had exploded, but the mine somehow treated that as if they were still there. It was a barrier, and these little pinpoints of light that were appearing among them, of course, were the fresh shells going in there. But you certainly had the feeling that you were trying to get through an impenetrable barrier because of these bursts there. But fighters were certainly the worst things that we feared. We were very fortunate. We only had two attacks by fighters, and or two, not even attacks. We only got fired at once, and that was over over Yorkshire by an enemy fighter. We might have had attacks which we'd avoided because using the various devices you could turn off if you felt a fighter was coming in towards you. I've forgotten the device that we used to carry in the tail at a certain stage. Again, later it was found this also gave our position away. But fighters were certainly the things that brought aircraft down. We were extremely lucky in that we never were exposed, as far as we know, to attack from these aircraft that they introduced in, I think it was 1944, the upward-firing cannon aircraft. The RAF were completely at sea over this. They never realised for months what was happening and how our losses were suddenly mounting. But the Germans had pinched a technique of ours, a technique which we'd used in 1940 on the Defiant, of having upward firing guns. And in 1944, I think it was, they produced this, there was a name for it, Musica, something Musica. It was a slang name which was used, and it accounted for a lot of aircraft during that period, because the aircraft was able to fly undetected under the aircraft, and they could do it so well they could even determine to within feet where they were going to fire. And they used to fire under the starboard outer wing into the petrol tanks on that side, and they would wait until they got exactly to that, and then they would open fire with a cannon. A lot of aircraft went down and no one had a clue as to why they'd gone down. One or two planes did report seeing what they thought were upward firing cannons, but this was disregarded by the Air Ministry for months until finally it realised that they had introduced this. Music.
Doesn't matter about the name.
Okay. But anyway, this technique at that stage, late stage of the war, really was bringing aircraft down. The only time we really engaged a fighter seriously, he wasn't attacking us, he was attacking another aircraft. On one raid, unfortunately I haven't noted in my logbook, I'd just dropped the bombs over the target, but I'd been keeping an apprehensive eye on a Halifax just above us with his bomb bays open and his bombs still there. We'd been hit on two previous trips by other people's bombs, once seriously, and so we were very careful not to position ourselves that way, and we were watching this as I dropped the bomb, so I looked up. At that moment, a Focke-Wulf 190 cut across our nose, so close you felt you could touch it. He obviously hadn't seen us, but he dropped back under the tail of this other Halifax, which was, as I say, just above us. And for what seemed minutes, no one in the crew said anything, but apparently, as I was watching, so was the pilot, so was the engineer, and the mid-upper gunner, all shocked to see this thing come in quite so close. Then suddenly we all let yell at the same time. The mid-upper gunner realised he ought to be doing something. The plane was absolutely point blank. He forgot all his drill. He'd never fired at a German aircraft before.